reasons why women should have the vote are obvious to every fair-minded person. We have waited too long for political justice. We refuse to wait any longer.
This is no simple reform. It really is a revolution.
An inclusive and intersectional feminism that calls upon all of us to join the resistance to racism, to Islamophobia, to anti-Semitism, to misogyny, to capitalist exploitation.
And our pussies ain't for grabbing.
Hello, and welcome to the Same Shit, Different Century podcast. I'm Hannah Monkley.
And I'm Amy Trend.
And today we don't have an Amy Toll because she couldn't make it, unfortunately. We miss you, Amy.
We miss you.
Today's episode is on the militant tactics of the suffragettes and did the ends justify the means? So I'll start off just explaining about militancy. The word militant means a vigorously active, combative and aggressive action, especially in support of a cause. And this can and has been interpreted in many different ways and for many different causes, some good and some terrible. Also, I guess the fact that the word terrorism comes under this heading is also true. And I'm sure some people thought the suffragettes were terrorists of a kind at the time. Especially as their tactics got, you know, progressed to things like arson and bombing. However, the suffragettes did vow to never harm a living thing, and they instead aimed their violence against property, not people. And I found like some proper evidence of this. One suffragette who was interviewed in 1965 said, "Mrs. Pankhurst gave us strict orders about those fires. There was not a cat or canary to be killed. No life. We were only allowed to give our lives." So I think there's sort of evidence in the suffragette magazine as well. Sort of, they just knew that it would ruin their cause. You know, if anybody was harmed, the newspapers would have a field day. So I'll say a couple of the tactics that they used, and I'll sort of mention some stories as I go through. Their tactics included public disturbance at cabinet ministers' meetings, which I've spoken about in my previous episode, so I won't say much about that. Chaining themselves to railings, throwing stones through windows, destroying post boxes and telephone wires, climbing on roofs and throwing slates, tax resistance, which I've talked about before, boycotting the census, which I've talked about before as well, destroying artwork, arson and bombing, and there's also a few other more inventive methods, which are pretty funny, that I'll talk about at the end. Before I started researching this topic, with a sort of limited knowledge that I had, I would sort of picture the suffragettes carrying out these deeds like in a showreel with something like the Benny Hill soundtrack because they seemed so like such like mischievous capers, didn't they?
Do you know what I mean?
However, the more I read into it, the more I realised how serious and important these things were to the movement and how much these women actually risked by carrying them out. And so to start off the stories, I have a short quote from Emmeline Pethick Lawrence, who sums up the use of militant tactics really well, I think. This quote is really short, and I just think it sums it up brilliantly. She said, "Doing something silly is the woman's alternative for doing something cruel." Mm. Which is true. It's true. They didn't harm a living thing, but they had to make an intolerable situation by doing these, at first silly and then slightly more dangerous, but, you know, doing these crazy things to get, you know, to get the attention they needed.
And just from, you know, they've been signing petitions and doing things peacefully for such a long time, since like was it 1860 and 1863 or whatever, and it wasn't getting them anywhere, so they had to find a way to kind of up the level and get notice.
And there are so many people who do these militant things for causes, for other causes. They up the level to violence that harm people and, you know, physical violence and cruelty.
Mm-hmm.
And they manage to do this thing, damage property and, create this intolerable situation without harming anybody physically. And it's just fantastic, really. So the first one I'll talk about, which was sort of something that they escalated sort of in 1908, was when they chained themselves to railings. So I've got an example of this. It was when Parliament was about to sit for their first cabinet council of the season. The suffragettes wanted to press their point about women's claim being brought up in this new session. So at Downing Street, the press were all there waiting to get, as Sylvia Pankhurst said, material for foolish paragraphs describing their appearance and manner of arrival. Something that still happens today, like with, what was it, Theresa May's, she wore like leather pants one time.
Oh yeah, did she wear
last year or something.
Or suede trousers or something.
Yeah, something, everybody's like, they're commenting on, you know, their appearance.
What she wears. And she also wore a red suit, didn't she? And she looked like a massive Labour supporter.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's happened then, still happening now. So a suffragette, Miss New, and another one, Nurse Olivia Smith, knowing this would be a great platform for them, started making a speech outside 10 Downing Street. But beforehand, they chained themselves to the railings, symbolising the political bondage of womanhood and also to prevent them from being dragged away. So while the police were busy trying to get them loose, another suffragette, quite a famous one, Mrs. Drummond, pulled up in a taxi, leaped out onto the roadside and ran into 10 Downing Street. So she actually got inside, but then obviously was arrested and they were all arrested, but it got huge press attention. Mm. Another chaining up story that I love, it's about the Ladies' Gallery in the House of Commons.
Yeah.
As you can imagine by the name, this is the only place where women were allowed at the time, and they could watch the proceedings through the metal bars.
Well, barely watch the proceedings.
But they literally had to stand behind metal bars to watch, you know, what was going on, you know, laws that's ridiculous. Anyway, this was carried out by Muriel Matters and some other suffragists from the Women's Freedom League, not the WSPU. They interrupted a Conservative speaker with the Votes for Women cry. And when attendants rushed to grab them, they found they had chained their waists to the grill. So they tried to gag their mouths with their hands, the attendants did, but they could still be heard crying, we have remained behind this insulting grill too long, which I think also applies to the Votes for Women as well as the literal grill that they were behind. They had actually wrapped wool around their chains so they wouldn't make a clanking sound when they chained them up.
Mm-hmm.
And they secured them with padlocks that they hadn't brought the keys with them to. So the only way the attendants could get them out was to remove the actual grill that they were attached to and drag them out by that until they could get someone who had a file to like file them off the grill, which is awesome because obviously they got a lot of press attention. They did get arrested. Obviously they got a lot of press attention, which was what they wanted. But they also removed the grill that they'd been stuck behind, so that's cool.
And I feel like this grill somewhere now that you can go and see it, or am I imagining that? I feel like I've seen it on display somewhere.
Oh, amazing.
But I might be making it up. It possibly is. It's somewhere like that, or it might be the Women's Library.
They've got some collection, haven't they?
I might be completely making that up, but look into it.
Yeah, that'd be so cool. So another militant tactic that is pretty famous is stone throwing. And
so yeah, this is what I always, so before we started doing all the research, this is what I always had in my head as a suffragette.
As a suffragette thing,
Wearing a sash and throwing a stone. Smashing windows.
Yeah.
Shouting votes for women.
Yes. So Emmeline Pankhurst called this the argument of the stone. In 1909, after she and some other suffragettes' deputation was rejected for the Bill of Rights, groups of suffragettes later that evening gathered, and they were each given a striped denim Dorothy bag containing stones wrapped in brown paper and tied with string.
What's a Dorothy bag?
I literally think it's just a little, like, drawstring...
Okay.
...bag. You know, like, before skirts had pockets?
Like a little reticule.
Yeah. The bags were attached around the waist under the skirt and could be reached through a placket pocket, so just like a slip. Okay. When the signal was given to throw them, Ada Wright, one of the stone throwers, said this. To women of culture and of sheltered upbringing, the deliberate throwing of a stone, even as a protest, in order to break a window, requires an enormous amount of moral courage. After much tension and hesitation, I threw my stone through the office window of the office works.
Yeah.
To my relief, I was at once arrested and marched off by two policemen, the tremendous crowd making way for us and cheering to the echo, all the way to Cannon Row Police Station. Mm. So I think the most famous stone throwing incident was on the 1st of March. In my notes, I've typed it up wrong. 2012.
I'm sure there was a stone thrown incident in 2012.
Maybe, but that's not what happened. 1912. And the Times chronicled it quite well. They said, some hundreds of women sallied forth carrying large muffs, again, fabric muffs, not rude muffs, in which hammers were concealed. And at a given moment, according, it is believed, to a preconcerted signal, they went up to the plate glass windows of various shops and deliberately smashed them with the hammers. The destruction done was immense. The large plate glass windows of traders of all kinds, caterers, tobacconists, shoemakers, drapers, print sellers, stationers, and many others were ruined in this ruthless way. Were it not for the calculated and determined manner in which this work of devastation was carried out, one would suppose it to have been wrought by demented and maniacal creatures.
I remember seeing once, like during the, I think it was during the festival research that we did, there was like a little notice that a shop had put in the window saying like, dear suffragettes, please don't smash our windows. Oh. But they did.
They did anyway.
Oh. Which it felt kind of bad.
Well, it's funny you should say about that because naturally the shop owners were pretty angry about having their windows smashed. Mm-hmm. But I have an excerpt from a WSPU leaflet here, and that clearly explains why they used this tactic and their, you know, their reasons. You, a prosperous shopkeeper, have had your windows broken and your business interfered with. You are very angry about it, and no wonder. But you are angry with the wrong people. You are angry with the women who broke your windows, whereas you ought to really be angry with the people who drove them to it. Mm. Those people are the members of the present government. Well, you may say, I sympathise with the women, but what have I got to do with it? Why should my windows be broken because cabinet ministers are a band of rogues and tricksters? My dear sir, you have everything to do with it. You are a voter, and therefore the members of the government are your servants. And if they do wrong, you are really responsible for it. That is why your windows are broken, to make you realise your responsibility in this matter.
What a great letter.
Yeah. And their actions did not stop any of these shops advertising in the suffragette newspaper. And the Times actually claimed afterwards that their actions caused insurance companies to get a huge harvest in profits.
Mm.
So I assume that's not from people making claims. It's from people, one, needing insurance after their windows have been broken, going, oh, shit, I need insurance.
Yeah.
These women are crazy. On another occasion in 1913, which I love this, Leonora Cohen was in London down from Leeds for a deputation to Lloyd George. And she stayed down in London afterwards to go to the Jewel House in the Tower of London. She had an iron bar concealed beneath her coat and threw it at a glass case displaying the Order of Merit. Wrapped around the bar was a piece of paper that read, "This is my protest against the government's treachery to the working class women of Great Britain."
I watched something that was talking about Leonora Cohen doing that, and it said about how she went there and she was so nervous, so she kind of like then went and walked around the block tried to psych herself up again.
Worse than that, I mean, worse, but like kind of understandably, she said she was so nervous that when it was time for her to get off at the tube stop for the Tower of London...
Oh, did she go round on the circle line?
Yeah,
that was it.
So the circle, for those of you who aren't familiar, the circle line
Doesn't go round anymore, does it?
It used to literally just go in a circle around London, so you could just stay on it and constantly circle London. So she was so nervous, she just was like, nope, I'm staying on, and went round the whole way of London again, until she worked up the courage to get off, which is really
so sweet.
Really sweet. And to be honest, I'd probably be the same.
Yeah, I probably would have gone around twice.
Yeah.
But it just kind of, it shows you how kind of human, kind of
It wasn't easy actions, for them. It really wasn't easy for them.
It was really tough, but it was just something they knew was important.
Yeah. And she was arrested, but she couldn't actually be charged because the damage came to under £5, which is below the legal limit for prosecution.
No way.
But it did get a lot of media attention, which is cool. And also, the window smashing is so important because it escalated loads after Black Friday, which I spoke about in my last episode. It's because they were like, we can't keep going on these deputations, on these marches, and just getting molested and beaten up by police with no arrests made. Because if they arrest us, they can't beat us up.
Do you think it's that case of if they're all kind of congregated in a group, it's much easier for the police to target them? But the window smashing campaign, I guess they were more like individual people.
Yeah, I think they did them in like much smaller groups, so it kind of like
to kind of
hide the hammers you know, in their muffs and then whip them out. But it also meant that the police would just like, right, you're arrested, and it just make the whole process a lot quicker rather than them being literally like beaten up, and chased
and molested
and awfulness. So it was like a more. It was a publicity stunt, but it was also a quicker way for them to get arrested.
And it was an obvious crime that they were committing wrong rather than just
marching. Around. Yeah, exactly. So another one, which we've spoken briefly about before, is destroying post boxes and telephone wires. So on the 15th of December 1911, Emily Wilding Davidson, one of the union's more erratic members, shall we say, set three post boxes ablaze by lighting pieces of linen saturated with paraffin and thrusting them through the letter slots. She said afterwards, "I did this entirely on my own responsibility." And she was sentenced to 6 months in prison for that. Interestingly, at first, the WSPU did not support this kind of violence. And Votes for Women, the suffragette magazine, gave her like only a brief mention on an inside page because they didn't want to support it at first.
I remember my prison episode saying this was when a lot of people started to actually leave the WSPU as well because their tactics were getting just a little bit too
dangerous,
and people were like, okay, I don't think this is for me.
Yeah. On the evening of the 26th of November 1912, the WSPU members poured acid ink, lamp black and tar into postal pillarboxes in the City of London, the West End and some other cities around the UK. I think lamp black is that gooey stuff you were talking about in the other episode. Yeah, the
syrupy stuff.
Yeah.
I still don't quite know what it is, but it
sounds
gooey.
Gross. Thousands of pieces of mail were destroyed. In Newcastle alone, 2,000 letters were damaged. Mm. The destruction was carried out secretly and the perpetrators escaped arrest.
Apart from Rosemary Billinghurst.
Apart from Rosemary Billinghurst, who got caught, but she was glad to be caught.
Yeah.
And it hadn't been put in the papers then, so she wanted it in the papers. And then Mrs. Pankhurst made clear to the public the union's advocacy of and responsibility for the destroying of the letters. On another occasion, Mrs. Nielsen and Mrs. Chapin destroyed ballot papers. I think it was in a local election, which women were allowed to vote in local elections.
Yeah.
Local elections are coming up in London, guys, so make sure you vote.
Get down your polling office.
I had a dream last night.
Yeah, like, I remember you saying.
I had a dream that Jeremy Corbyn came to me and I was like, oh, where I live, it's just like really Tory, so I don't think I'm going to vote. And he was like, no, you can make a difference. You should vote. And you do a suffragette podcast. So, and he was really like telling me off. And I was like, no, you're right, Jeremy.
He has a point.
I was like, okay, I'll vote. I just thought it was really funny. Yes, so they went to a local election and they poured a mixture of ink and photographic chemicals onto the ballot papers. They only destroyed five, but still. Apparently, some splashed up into a Mr. Thorley's eye, who claimed that he would be blind for life as a result.
Oh, Mr. Thorley.
And he went around with a patch on his eye for weeks until a member of the Women's Freedom League caught him not wearing it and his eye seemed to be fine. visibility, so. yeah. So the next one is... tax resistance, which I've spoken about a bit before, but I found some interesting stories about it that we haven't spoken about before. So Anne Cobden Sanderson set up the Tax Resistance League, and 220 women took part in it between 1906 and 1918.
I'm surprised it's not more, actually.
I was surprised too.
Yeah.
Because
it seems so like such a obvious thing, like,
and why... you know, quite an easy thing to do. You just don't pay taxes, which sounds, well,
terrible. But
sounds terrible.
If you dip, but like, I mean, it for the sounds cause. Terrible now, but we have, like, we have a vote and we have a say in what this tax money is spent on. But at this time,
although
you wouldn't have, you'd get your money taken, but you just wouldn't have any say in what would happen with it.
Exactly. They did actually suspend the Resistance League from 1914 throughout the First World War, because of war effort stuff. So they paid council tax because they could vote in local elections and had a say over that, but did not pay national tax, property tax, income tax, and licensing fees. And women from all three suffragist groups participated in it. So the WSPU, Women's Freedom League, and MUWSS. Dora Montefiore, if I'm saying that right, refused to pay tax for 3 years and barricaded herself in her house when the bailiffs came. So Annie Kenny and Teresa Billington brought 50 suffragists in support. And then it became known as the Siege of Montefiore because, like, all bailiffs are trying to get in and these suffragettes are like, no, you won't get in. When her goods were finally seized, she bought them back herself at auction because all the suffragettes were there. And, you know, if no one in the audience is bidding, then you can buy them back for super cheap. Yeah. So many rich women participated in the tax dodge, as I mentioned in the Sophia episode. But a tax that more middle-class women were persecuted for, whereas richer women were often passed over for, was the dog tax. So you had to pay tax to have a dog, you had to have a license.
So rich women didn't have to pay?
Well, they did the dodge, but they weren't persecuted for it. It was kind of like, well, for whatever reason. For example, Sophia Duleep Singh had 8 dogs, as we know, and she was never penalised for not paying her dog taxes, whereas Emma Sprozen, who refused to pay hers, was imprisoned twice in Stafford, and the judge tried to place her in the third division in prison, which, as we know, is the worst, absolute worst one for the worst criminals. And while she was in prison, the police shot her dog.
What?
Yeah.
That is just...
She's taken out on the dog.
So this goes back to, you know, you were saying about how they vowed never to hurt a cat or dog as well as a human. And then you've got the police go in. Sorry, this bugs me because I love dogs.
So we all. I know, it's like that dog, you know...
That's absolutely disgusting.
Leave the animals out of it, guys.
So it's so much worse. Like, what the police did to them is so much worse than any of the worst crimes that they did.
Yeah, well, I haven't written this in my notes, but at doing my reading, all these militant activities, the violence that was heaped upon the suffragettes, like, what the suffragettes did paled in comparison to the violence they received. And they were also the victim of militant tactics. Like, in some suffragettes meetings... A load of mice were released to scare the women.
What?
A load of sparrows were released. As we've like spoken about before, they got pelted with rotten fruit and veg and urine.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, they got dead mice thrown at them. Christabel did. And not to mention all the horrible violence and assault. So, you know. Anyway.
Along with being beaten up and
yeah,
molested and
all that horrible, horrible stuff. So yeah, when it comes to destroying art, we've spoken a bit about this before.
Mm-hmm.
About in 1914, Mary Richardson destroyed the Rokeby Venus. Am I saying that right?
Rokeby. I think so.
Rokeby Venus.
I think. How's it spelled?
Rokeby.
That's what I feel like. That's how I've always heard it.
She saw a so when she went up to do it, she saw a detective who was resting in front of the painting. And when he put his newspaper up in front of his face, she went up to the painting and smashed it with an axe.
That's so comedy.
I know, it's like a film. He, like, raised his painting and she's like, here we go, smashed it. So here's what she said. This is her account. The sound of the glass breaking also attracted the attention of an attendant at the door, who, in a frantic attempt to reach me, slipped on the highly polished floor and fell face forwards. and so I was given time to get in a further four blows with my axe.
Oh my God.
Before I was in turn attacked. It's like a comedy
sketch. It is like a comedy sketch.
two Bedecker guidebooks aimed by German tourists came cracking against the back of my neck. So people were so like, oh my God, these two German tourists like threw their books at her. Like, oh, what are they doing? God. The detective sprang on me and dragged the axe from my hand. As if out of the very walls, angry people seemed to appear around me. I was dragged this way and that, but the fury of the crowd helped me. In the ensuing commotion, we were all mixed together in a tight bunch. No one knew who or who should not be attacked. More than one innocent woman must have received a blow meant for me.
Oh no.
After the policeman apprehended her, they said, "Any more of your women in the gallery?" "Oh, I expect so," I replied, knowing full well there were none. "My God," he shouted, and flung his cap down on the floor and ran from the room. So I quite like that. She was like, yeah, that's probably loads.
That's like loads.
And her reason for doing it, she said, "I have tried to destroy the picture of the most beautiful women in mythological history as a protest against the government for destroying Mrs. Pankhurst, who is the most beautiful character in modern history."
Hmm.
"Justice is an element of beauty as much as colour and outline on canvas. Mrs. Pankhurst seeks to procure justice for womanhood, and for this she is being slowly murdered by a government of Iscariot politicians. If there is an outcry against my deed, let everyone remember that such an outcry is an hypocrisy, so long as they allow the destruction of Mrs. Pankhurst and other beautiful living women. And that until the public cease to countenance human destruction, the stones cast against me for the destruction of this picture are each an evidence against them of artistic as well as moral and political humbug and hypocrisy." And as an upshot of this, which I quite like, but also is a bit annoying, all the art galleries and museums in London were so scared that suffragettes were going to come and destroy their works of art, that from then on, for a short time, women, any woman going into a gallery, when she bought her ticket, had to provide a letter with like a character reference to say like she wasn't a suffragette. Like you had to go. Yeah, it's crazy.
It would just like, yeah, it would just like wind you up even, they're just winding them up even more, aren't they?
Yeah.
And just kind of egging them on almost. That's what it would make me do anyway.
Yeah.
If someone did that to me, I'd just be like, right, well, I'm getting into that gallery and I am gonna slash a painting.
Yeah. So I'm moving on to arson and bombing, which is probably the most extreme thing the suffragettes did. In 1913, the WSPU arson campaign escalated, and railway stations, cricket pavilions, racecourse stands and golf clubhouses were being set on fire. Most of these places were symbols of masculinity and like manly masculine pursuits. So like, as well as setting them on fire, they'd like burn slogans in favour of women's suffrage into like the turf of the Greens.
Brilliant.
Yeah. On the 3rd of March 1912, Ellen Pitfield, a 45-year-old midwife afflicted with incurable cancer, entered the general post office and set fire to a basket of wood shavings saturated with paraffin. Her attempt at arson was purely symbolic, but she immediately proceeded to attract attention by throwing a brick through a window of the building. Ellen Pitfield's actions were not supported by the WSPU then. On 19th of March, she was sentenced to 6 months in prison, having been carried to court from a bed in the prison hospital. Released in May, she died on the 6th of August.
Aww.
Yeah, so that was in 1912. When the WSPU were like, oh no, that's a bit far. Mm-hmm. But then it, literally a year later, they were like, yes, arson is the way to go. Yeah. So now is a good time to reiterate that the suffragettes were told only to destroy property, not life. Like going back to that suffragette from who did a interview in 1965 saying, you know, Emmeline Pankhurst said, do not destroy any life, whether it's a cat or canary, only property.
And from what, like, most of what I've heard, they only seem to target property of kind of the rich.
Yeah.
People that it wouldn't necessarily financially kind of hurt them, that they could recover from it quite easily.
Yeah.
I've never heard instances of them kind of attacking, you know, like a little pub or something.
Yeah, or like a...
Or bakery.
Like, they smashed their windows, but they didn't, like, raise them to the ground. Like, yeah. They set on fire a couple of cabinet ministers' houses and things like that as well. And empty houses they did.
And Lloyd George's house.
Lloyd George, yeah. One of the first arsonists was Mary Richardson, who was the lady who destroyed the Rokeby Venus. She later recalled the first time she set fire to a building. I took the things from her and went on to the mansion. The putty of one of the ground floor windows was old and broke away easily, and I had soon knocked out a large pane of the glass. When I climbed inside into the blackness, it was a horrible moment. The place was frighteningly strange and pitch dark, smelling of damp and decay. A ghastly fear took possession of me, and when my face wiped against a cobweb, I was momentarily stiff with fright. But I knew how. Yeah, exactly. But I knew how to lay a fire. I had built many a campfire in my young days, and that part of the work was simple and quickly done. I poured the inflammable liquid over everything. Then I made a long fuse of twisted cotton wool, soaking that too as I unwound it, and slowly made my way back to the window at which I had entered. So yeah, it just goes to, you know, this was scary stuff. It's like spy stuff. It's like Mission Impossible stuff, yeah, you know, it like, is. You know.
I wonder how easy it would be to do now with kind of security, everyone's like up their security.
Mm.
I guess you still get break-ins, don't you?
So our favourite, Lillian Lenton,
woo,
was a serial arsonist. She set fire to many buildings, including the Tea Pavilion at Kew Gardens, which I went to last weekend.
Oh, did you?
But obviously it's been rebuilt.
Not the same.
Yeah, we've got pictures of it, which we'll put on the Instagram of it being burned, and it was literally, there was just sticks, just charcoal. Lillian Lenton stated that her aim was to burn two buildings a week in order to create such a condition in the country that it would prove impossible to govern without the consent of the governed.
Yeah, we'll have to do an episode on her soon.
Yeah.
She's so cool.
She set fire to, okay, that makes sense. So she fired to loads of stuff, and she was sort of in and out of jail all the time because of the arson. She was always, as you've mentioned before, she was always on hunger strike and forcibly fed, and became ill from being forcibly fed incorrectly. And not that there's a correct way to do it, because it's barbaric. So she was released on licence on the 15th of October from one of her imprisonments. She escaped from the nursing home and was arrested on the 22nd of December 1913 and charged with setting fire to a house in Cheltenham. After another hunger and thirst strike, she was released on the 25th of December to the care of Mrs. Impey in King's Norton. Once again, she escaped and evaded the police until early May 1914, when she was arrested in Birkenhead. So this was a woman who was really ill from all these imprisonments and forced feeding, and she was still setting fires. So I've got a little story about her, which is really funny. She was given two bombs by some guy who was like a suffragette sympathiser, because she famously said to a magistrate after one of her arson attempts, "No, I didn't have any grievances against the house owner, but whenever I see an empty house, I burn it." So she went to stay with a friend near Edinburgh, and she'd just been given these two bombs. And she told her mate about it, and her mate was so scared when she found out she had two bombs in her bag. And she was like, "No, go to my friend's house, which is near Edinburgh. And she's got a big lake in her grounds, so I want you to drop the bombs in the lake, because like setting fires is one thing, but bombs is another. They're a lot more volatile." So at this time, she'd already been arrested loads and was wanted under the Cat and Mouse Act. And
this is one of her many escapes.
Well, kind of. So it meant that any policeman who saw her could arrest her at any time.
Mm-hmm.
So when she got to Edinburgh, she brazenly went up to a policeman and asked for directions to this house. And he said, "I'm just going off duty myself. I'll take you." And she just went, "That's very kind of you. Thank you." And then he offered to carry the case with the bombs in. And she just said, "Thank you very much. It's rather heavy." And then he took her around the streets of Edinburgh carrying her bombs for her.
That's hilarious.
She's so, like, ballsy. I love it. It's great, isn't it? So talking about bombs, in February 1913, Lloyd George's Weekend Cottage, which is in the process of being built, was the target of a small explosion. And in June 1914, a bomb was placed beside the coronation chair in Westminster Abbey.
Mm.
Yeah, it exploded, causing slight damage to the chair and the Stone of Destiny below it. I don't know what that is, but it sounds important.
Sounds important, yeah.
The Stone of Destiny. Several other bombs were planted, including one in St. Paul's Cathedral and near the Bank of England. So,
yeah. I didn't know that.
I don't know if it's because homemade bombs are quite hard to make.
Yeah.
But apparently, like, the suffragettes weren't massively successful in their bomb making.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the fact that they just did them was enough to sort of alert the press.
Yeah.
So I've got another account here of some arson, which is pretty interesting. There was an... So after Emily Davidson's... Well, Emmy Wilding Davidson's went underneath the horse. On the night of her death, the greater part of the grandstand at Hurst Park was destroyed by fire. And many years later, Kitty Marion, who set the fire, recalled how it was done. She and Clara Given went to have a look at the race course and saw that the only way in was over a high fence with spikes and barbed wire on top. They borrowed a piece of carpet from Kitty's landlady and packed a suitcase with equipment in. They set out at 9 p.m. on the Sunday night, travelling by train and then by tram to the bridge near Hampton Court Palace. They managed to climb the fence with the aid of a tool shed, which was next to it, and their piece of carpet. Once inside, they found an unlocked door into the grandstand and there spread their inflammable material. As a timer, they placed a candle on the material and lit it. They thought it would take at least an hour to burn down and start the fire. so they'd have time to get away. However, I think the candle fell over as they were climbing over the fence, and the grandstand was already like blazing. They walked over the bridge and through Richmond and Kew, once again asking a policeman to redirect them, which is ballsy. When he asked why they were out so late, because it was 1 a.m, Kitty told him that she was a music hall singer on her way home. And the next morning they were arrested and they were given long prison sentences. Emmeline Pankhurst kind of dealt with the situation with a bit of gallows humour. She said that Emily gave up her life for the women's cause by throwing herself in the path of the thing next to property held most sacred to Englishmen, sport. And that's why they went on to destroy golf courses and race courses and things like that. Although the suffragettes vowed never to hurt anyone, and I maintain that that was mostly adhered to, there are a few cases of them using violence against people, which I should mention to sort of give a bit of balance.
Mm-hmm.
Winston Churchill was attacked with a riding crop at a train station, which I think is pretty funny.
Yeah.
and Asquith was set upon by two suffragettes while he was playing golf.
We talked about that before as well, haven't we?
Yeah.
They tried to rip his clothes off.
And it said, one of the suffragettes said, it was remarked that he was a much better boxer than he was a politician.
Yeah.
So I think he got a few punches in himself. He's quite a
good fighter.
Mm-hmm. A slightly more serious incident was in Ireland in 1912, after a cinema had been set alight by Gladys Evans and Mary Lee. And Asquith was visiting at the time, that's why they did it there. It was reported that Mary Lee threw a hatchet at a carriage that held Asquith and the Lord Mayor in it. No one was harmed except the Marshal John O'Brien, who restrained her, and she bit him hard on the face.
Hmm.
She got given 5 years in prison for that, but never served them because they force-fed her in cat and mouse, I think. But again, like, these, like, handful of incidences, like, the brutality that they faced on a daily basis...
Yeah.
...is so that's, much that's worse. That's, like,
four accounts that you've given of suffragettes hurting people, but,
you know, and there's always going to be, like...
Probably 20 straight away of instances where suffragettes have been... Well, more, because, like, every more. Single one that had been force-fed.
And there's always going to be a few over-enthusiastic people who take it too far in any movement. But, you know, I still think that on the whole, I just think that it was such a success what they did, like, aside from these handful of instances. Also, in the BBC, there's a BBC documentary that we listened to, wasn't there? Mm-hmm. About it was accounts of suffragettes and people who were there at the time. And Asquith's daughter speaks a bit, and she's very anti-suffrage. And she says oh, well, the suffragettes set fire to, I can't remember whose house it was, set fire to this cabinet minister's house, and there were children in the nursery, and they knew there were children in the nursery. But that's, like, bollocks.
Yeah, I've heard another account of them setting fire to a house, and it was a servant...
Went back inside,
yeah. But they hadn't realised that she had gone back inside.
Yeah.
And she was okay, but I think a lot of people used that against them, and that, like, she could have been hurt easily, but they genuinely didn't know that she was in there. It's a dangerous game to play, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anything with fire.
Yeah, a fire and bombs, there's a huge element of risk. But then would women have got the vote so quickly if they hadn't resorted to arson? Because they really, that upped the ante hugely. Mm-hmm. It was the biggest militant thing they did. I'll end on a bit of a lighter note with some more inventive methods of militancy. another one is a lot of false fire calls from public telephones. They prank called. Which you should not do. Do not do that now.
Memories of my childhood.
Amy!
That's really...
Amy, not to that!
But we used to, like, prank kind of like BT and
oh
stuff.
Yeah, that's fine.
You know, like order pizzas for people. But never the emergency services.
No, good. Yeah, they prank all the emergency services, the fire department, from public telephones. But that's kind of like, that seems quite mischievous, like, ooh, that's a fire. Anyway, in 1909, an example of a good militant stunt that involved no violence was when two suffragettes posted themselves from the Strand to the Downing Street under a new regulation that allowed you to allowed the posting and delivering of human letters. So I think Amy Toll mentioned in a previous episode the postal service was a huge deal back then. People, you could get post delivered 12 times a day, mm-hmm. because it was a big method of communication, obviously. And I went to a talk years ago. This guy was saying, there was this guy at the time who was fascinated by the postal service. So he would post the craziest of things to see if they would get delivered, including himself. And that's where human letters became a thing. So Georgina Solomon and Miss McClellan were posted by Jessie Kenny, who is Annie Kenny's sister, to Prime Minister Asquith at 10 Downing Street. So the women went with the telegraph boy, one woman wearing a poster card advertising that Wednesday's demonstration of the suffragettes, and the other one carried a destination card with Asquith's name and address written in bold.
So they didn't put them in a box.
No, the telegraph boy, like, they flanked him, and when they arrived.
Well, I saw like this news story where this man posted himself to his girlfriend.
What, now? Like,
yeah,
recently?
A couple of years ago, and he nearly died.
Oh my god!
I mean, that's not
what he was in a box.
But he put himself in a box and, like, actually posted him, like, put himself in the post.
What a nut! So just get in a box about 2 days. Write an address on it and pretend that you post. Okay. Well, the suffragettes were a bit more sensible. They walked. When they arrived, his butler said, "You must be returned." The women protested, "But we have been paid for." "Well, then," the butler said, "the post office must deliver you somewhere else. You can't be delivered here. You must be returned. You are dead letters."
Ooh.
Yes. But that got loads of press attention because it was just a really clever, inventive thing that nobody had thought to do.
Mm.
Another incident was when the suffragettes had a Black Maria van, which was what the police took prisoners away in. It bore the inscription EP for Emmeline Pankhurst, and a man dressed as a policeman rode on the back step. But when the van reached Regent Street, a group of women dressed in prison dress emerged and proceeded to give out handbills to passers-by and, like, chalk advertisements on paper. Pavement, so that's quite a cool publicity stunt.
Sounds like really Edinburgh Festival.
Yeah, like performance art.
Yeah.
It's really cool. And then this is one of my faves, because it sounds like something from a film. An incident which I read about, this is in Sylvia Pankhurst's book that she wrote, The Suffragette, told the story. It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon at the Stranger's Entrance of the House of Commons. Two furniture removal vans slowly approached. The first, they were both like at a crawling pace, and the second one was following after the first one, with a sleepy looking boy lying on the back ledge of it, and he was keeping his eyes fixed on a man sauntering along the pavement some distance away. And just as the van passed the stranger's entrance, the man on the pavement dropped his handkerchief. The boy sprang from the ledge, the back doors of the van flew open wide, and 21 women jumped out and made a rush for the Houses of Commons.
Mm.
Unfortunately, they were blinded by the sudden light after being in the dark for so long. And so as they jumped out, pretty much all of them just fell over or ended up running the wrong way. Two of them did manage to get inside, but then obviously they were instantly arrested. But I just love that as an image, like a real, like, covert military operation. And then yeah. The women are like, aha! And then they're just like, oh, God! um, But yeah, so I mean, that is just one, that's just a few of the many, many, many stories. There's a lot in the Sylvia Suffragette book, which I really like, because it was written at the time. There's a few, like, where a lot of women would, they'd climb up onto roofs where cabinet ministers were speaking, and they'd like create a massive racket, and they'd tear the roof tiles off the roof, and throw them, not at people, but just like, you know, destroying the property. And I think it was Mrs. Lee, who, she was quite a prominent suffragette in Liverpool. Way, mm-hmm. That's where I'm from.
Way.
Not you can guess from my accent, unfortunately. but yeah, and then on one occasion, the police were like, the firemen were there to try and get them down off ladders, but they couldn't reach them. So the police were like, turn the hoses on them. And these women are just like on the roof.
Mm.
And the firemen were like, well, no, because they'll fall off and die. Mm. But the police were like, no, we're doing it. And just like, and then they were soaked and, you know, freezing cold. They managed to stay on the roof, and they got down fine. But
yeah.
When they were arrested, they were just soaked to their skin and freezing and taken to jail that way. So.
And again, another example of the police risking these women's lives.
Yep. And not acting with correct, or what should be correct, procedure. But yeah, if the, you know, the question of this episode was, did the ends justify the means, or do the ends justify the means when it comes to militancy? And I think in this case, absolutely, because there was no damage to human or any life, just property. And I think the cause, it was an excellent one. I know all different causes are subjective, and everyone has different opinions on different things.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly when it comes to quality, you know,
it's that case, isn't it, that like, it's probably, you know, like 99% of the time it was fine, like nobody got harmed, but there's always, you know, that 1% that took it maybe too far, and there's always kind of some extremist people that may have then kind of targeted humans in a way that wasn't really acceptable. But generally, yes, it did.
The ends definitely justified the means. And I think in anything like modern protests and militancy, I think
there's always damage one to person.
Well, yeah, there's always one person, but I think damage to property.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a massive inconvenience, but that is what the aim is. It's like, yes, we're going to cause an inconvenience to you because this is how strongly we feel. And as long as you're not like setting off disgusting nail bombs in the middle of a shopping mall and mm-hmm. and all that sort of thing.
You know, like when you're on the train and you see kind of political messages graffitied mm. on like along the train rails, and like, you know, it's not technically, it's illegal, but it's not hurting anyone.
No, and it is, and it's spreading the message. Yeah, I love attention.
Looking at them. I read them. Yeah.
Yeah, and like what I'm trying to think of,
Banksy.
Like,
Banksy's technically
yeah
a criminal. He's doing yeah. wrong, but
he's spreading some amazing
messages. And he kind of teaches amazing messages to people.
And like, I'm thinking about like, I'm trying to think of like, aside from like the terrorists that we know of who like set off bombs to hurt people and things like that, I've now think of other things that might be determined as terrorist attacks, like environmentalists.
Yeah, like chaining yourself to a tree.
Yeah, actually, Ellie, who we work with, who we mentioned on our last podcast from the Take It Up, Wear It Out blog, she was saying that now there are some environmental protesters, and they've been chaining themselves to railings for years. And rather than the police just coming around with bolt cutters to cut the chains, they put piping on their arms that they attach the chains to, so that it's not as easy. So their arms are like that, literally arm is attached to the railings. But then they would get like heat thermal imaging like cutters.
Oh
so
my God.
When their arm, like I guess when you cut a cast off, you know.
Yeah.
So what they did to counterbalance that was put wire wool in the the piping, so the thermal cutters couldn't identify where the arm was and where the wool was.
And also, you know, we're talking in the Rosemary Billenhurst episode about the disabled protesters chaining themselves to buses to get disabled access onto public transport, which just seems like something that's so obvious, but it got the job done.
Yeah, it's a very, very, very effective effective way.
And also, people, I think we were talking about this the other day, protesters chaining themselves to runways or laying on runways to stop planes
taking off with refugees. Yeah. It's good, and it works.
It works. It's got the media attention, and it's not hurting anyone.
It's not hurt. So yeah, that is my conclusion. As long as no life gets, you know, put at risk or as nobody gets killed or hurt, and I include animals in that.
Yes.
It's fine and it's good and it's worth it.
Yes.
Now go and smash some windows, guys. I'm only joking.
But no, it's maybe not smash a window, but like act.
Yeah, do something. Deeds, not words.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Brilliant.
Thank you. Oh, thanks. So thanks so much for listening. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. That will like really, really help us loads.
And we've forgotten to write down our details again. We'll learn one day. But if you've got anything that you'd like us to discuss, or you've got any questions that you'd like to hear a bit more about, because it's getting really difficult to kind of fit everything into these little hour episodes that we're trying to do, we've got so much to say.
Yeah.
Just contact us, and we're going to start definitely kind of progressing away from suffragettes and talking a bit more in general about women from history that have kind of pioneered for the rights that we have today. So if there's anything you'd be interested in hearing about, just let us know. Our email address is thesuffragettecity@gmail.com, and you can also follow us on Instagram at the.suffragettecity, where we will be posting lots of pictures to kind of go along with what we're saying. So we'll post the picture of the burnt down tea house at Kew Gardens.
Yeah.
And also, just to remind you, we are selling some t-shirts that say same shit, different century, and also a new design by Amy Toll, who's not here today, but she's done a lovely picture for us, and it's on t-shirts, and you can find them at suffragettecity.tmail.co.uk, and 100% of the profits that we make from that get donated to the amazing charity Abortion Rights UK.
Which is very important now, because the referendum for the abortion question has been announced, hasn't it? Now it's on the 25th of May in Ireland.
Yep.
So they need all the help they can get. It's hopefully, fingers crossed, going to be a big result and a real step forward for Ireland.
So we want to help them as much as we can. So please buy a t-shirt.
Yeah.
And they're all ethically made.
Yeah. From wind farms. Yeah.
With organic cotton.
Yes. So thanks again for listening, guys. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.